Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi and welcome to the podcast. I hope you're well. It finally feels like the teeniest bit of spring might be coming. It's been so grey, hasn't it? So dark and grey for ages, day after day. But the most beautiful sunrise this morning, and there's just a tiny feeling of spring in the air. So, wow, that feels good. And I feel like I'm rocking at the moment because I just went to see Russell Brand again last night. Oh, what a show. Russell Brand, I'm hoping. Oh, wouldn't it be amazing if I get him on the podcast? Just be amazing. You never know. Let's cross everything. So we've got a great show lined up for you today. I've teamed up with ED Spirits. I've told you about this company before, so I'm just going to tell you a little bit about their unique drink, absolutely unique. I know I'm always banging on about amazing alcohol-free drinks, but this really is very unusual and just totally disrupting the market, really. It's really amazing drink. And also my guest is Mark Holmes, who is CEO and founder of the Addiction Help Agency. So that's a different kind of interview for me, because obviously I usually interview people who are very much working with grey area drinkers. But Mark has a different kind of background, trained as an alcohol addiction CBT therapist, and has written a great book, Holmes' Complete Guide to Stop Drinking Alcohol, The Easy, Mindful and Pain-Free Way. Just while I think of it, did you see yet another piece in the press this week? There's been a whole run of them recently. I think I told you a couple of weeks ago there was the piece about I don't know, something to do with how good for you alcohol is, all of that nonsense over again. And then there was one that actually disputed that, which is a bit of a one-off, saying, no, actually, any amount of alcohol is not good for you. That caused a little bit of a furore. And then earlier in the week, there was another piece saying that drinking wine helps to avoid COVID infection. Really? Really? Okay. It's actually getting funny now. You need to just have a little check of that kind of study. Check who funds it and just, you know, have a little think logically. I mean, you know, might we want to be thinking about immunity and, you know, not adding in a depressant, fuel to the fire and all of that. Anyways, so let me tell you about this amazing brand. It was John Eric Vernier, I hope I've said that right, and Alexander Jacoby, who founded, wait for it, the Endorphin Dealer Institute. Isn't that the most fantastic name? ED for short. And they actually admit that they wanted to disrupt the market and they wanted to create enjoyment without the negative effects of alcohol. So this drink is called Spirited Euphoria by ED, and it's the world's first 100% natural hemp-based signature non-alcoholic distilled spirit. So this really is a fantastic alcohol-free drink, great if you want to have that kind of relaxing experience, but obviously not be intoxicated. And before you kind of panic and think that I'm promoting something that I shouldn't be, it is THC free, so it is not going to make you high. It's only got a couple of calories per serving. It's carb-free, it's vegan, it's gluten-free, all of that stuff. And I think one of the things that I realised about this brand is that they really do care about the sourcing, of their ingredients and everything else. It's they say, you know, it's the unique blend of natural hemp terpenes from the real hemp plants that make the difference. The purest CBD isolate, natural cognitive enhancing nootropics and relaxing adaptogens. That's what they say in the blurb. Nootropics, by the way, I'll admit, I wasn't sure what nootropics were. You hear this word quite a lot, but they're smart brain cognitive enhancing supplements. And in the ED drinks, they use nootropics that come from natural sources. And the ones in Spirited Euphoria include a whole bunch, but including vitamin B5, B5 and B6 and B12, and there's 5-HTP in there, and there's guarana and a whole bunch of other stuff. So this is really something very special. In fact, they're one of the only drinks in the world that unlocks the flavour of real hemp, thanks to the artistry they use, their molecular master blending, is the phrase, and their proprietary method for distilling endorphin spirits. So you've got this, and you're thinking, well, what does it taste like? It is really nice. It's a complex, layered balance. The marketing material says it's citrus green, herbaceous hemp and peppery spice with a smooth, woody finish. It's a really good description, because it's difficult to describe how it tastes. It's very light, and you can mix it with soda, a little bit of orange, that kind of highlights the hemp flavour. You can have it just with tonic, instead of having a G&T. I think it's really important as well. They say every drop of ED is fully traceable from seed to sip. Isn't that great? So they actually care about the provenance of their ingredients. And again, if you're thinking, oh my goodness, she shouldn't be talking about hemp, all of their liquids are tested to the highest level of the global regulatory services that do all of this kind of stuff. So it's all fully accredited by authorities. Because as they say, maximum relaxation takes a lot of effort, right? So it's a really unique drink. Beautiful bottle as well. Looks really good. So check it out. We've got a competition to win some as well. It's edspirits.com, edspirits.com. And if you go to the show notes and thesoberclub.com, you'll see our competition to win a box. So thank you to Edie for partnering with us on the podcast this week. As promised, let's hear this interview with Mark.
My guest is Mark Holmes, a CEO and founder of the Addiction Help Agency in London, who helps others to achieve permanent sobriety painlessly without using willpower and without craving. Sounds good. Mark is a former international school principal and high functioning alcoholic for over 30 years. Let's get into it. Mark, how are you?
I'm great, Jenny. Great to be here.
Yeah, really good to chat to you. So I came across your book, which you very kindly sent me, Holmes' Complete Guide to Stop Drinking Alcohol, The Easy, Mindful and Pain-Free Way. So let's dig into your story then. Tell us a bit about your background. I'm interested in your phrase, high-functioning alcoholic.
Yeah, well, it's got a bit of notoriety now, hasn't it, that term, high-functioning alcoholic. I use it in the sense of describing someone who can hold down a career, hold down a very successful career, and yet still have a sort of crutch there where they're dependent on alcohol. And I was very much dependent on alcohol, although I gave every excuse for not being. And I sort of lied to myself, I think, if I'm really honest, for many years. And I was thinking, well, I'm doing very well. I was a school teacher and head of department and then, assistant principal. And
was that in the UK? Was that in the UK?
Yeah, Mark? I did. I was right. In the UK, first of all, for 10 years.
I mean, I'm quite interested, just veering off for a second. I'm quite interested in that because when I did my TEDx talk, it was quite interesting because I was working there with a bunch of people who were some professors, some teachers, and they were talking a lot, these guys, about just how rife drinking is in the teaching profession. Oh, yeah. Now, I mean, I kind of think it is in every profession, but would you say that's true?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it is. I mean, it's very, very much true. There's a lot of strain, you see. There's a lot of stress and strain on teachers. And I mean, this is going back a little bit, but when you look at the introduction of Ofsted, and the league tables, suddenly, teachers were under an enormous amount of pressure.
Yeah.
And this was around the time when they're introducing, compulsory lesson plans for every lesson. Now I think that's accepted. But I was of the generation before where this was quite, a new thing, really. You knew your stuff. You knew what you wanted to accomplish in the lesson. Mm. But you didn't necessarily plan in detail the level of differentiation, the learning objectives, the assessment for learning. I mean, I can really bore you with that stuff, Jane, if you want. But this was a whole new thing. So for many teachers at that time, it was like learning a whole new vocabulary, a whole new way of performing to meet the criteria that had just been set up. Mm. And so teachers were under an incredible amount of pressure to try and deliver and being judged on, you know, on something where the criteria were not necessarily that, well, not necessarily that valid, if I may say. Teaching's got a lot to do with relationships and the rapport you have with your students and building up trust. And it's not just about memorizing facts. You know, you've got kind of holistic goals, the building self-esteem, the confidence. They are so important. Now, how do you put them on a, you know, on a sort of scale and specify those sort of more altruistic goals and sort of self-developmental goals? A lot of that got kind of, you know, put on the side while we're trying to tick boxes. It's felt like a tick boxing exercise. But yeah, forgive me, because I know I'm going off on a tangent here about teaching, which I can do anytime you want. But that pressure tends to result in a need for kind of relief from that. And when you're talking about teachers have been working all day in a very public role, I mean, you do your show, you know, and very amazingly kind of calm and relaxed, but you're performing and there's a lot of stress involved in that. And if you think about teaching, you're performing, you know, maybe 3 to 5 times a day. For your little audience. Okay, it's only a little audience, not millions, but it's still a lot of pressure. And then after that, you've got to do your planning and preparation, so you can be working quite late, and then you've got to get up, you know, in the morning to sort of start again. So, you know, you start, it can be a dangerous a dangerous downward path, can't it, where you start saying, I'll just have a little drink to help me sleep a bit better because I've got to get up in a few hours. And before you know it, it's becoming, you know, a tool.
And of course, it's so acceptable because everyone else is doing it.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, there's always a reason, isn't there? I mean, I suppose I should use the word excuse, because it's like there's not really a good reason. It's always like, okay, I want to use it for this purpose. So I'm going to use alcohol to relax, or I'm going to use alcohol to celebrate, or I'm going to use alcohol because I've had a bad day, or, you know, and it's like this kind of multifaceted tool, where in fact it's obviously not. But, you know, it becomes, you get it, it kind of convinces you that it is. And I think in any high powered job, I mean, look at the incidence of alcoholism in medicine.
Oh my God. And,
you know, it's frightening.
Yeah.
And in law, in the legal profession, it's, so I don't want to be too hard on the teachers here, and saying, you know, how prevalent it is, but in any career, and I think, I suppose a valid point here is when we think about all careers, any, you know, people think alcoholism is associated with, you know, people who are sleeping in doorways, uneducated, and, you know, this really, the sort of lowest rung of life, you know, the down and out in London and Paris, as George Orwell wrote. It's not. It's very much, you know, if you actually look at the stats, and I do look at that a little bit in the book, you know, you're talking about middle, upper class, well-educated, professional people on high incomes.
Yeah, absolutely. When you looked at those stats, did you actually find any kind of definitives on what percentage of people might be, you know, drinking more than they want to? Because, you know, this is something that, as you know, I talk about a lot, the fact that, you know, yes, of course, we tend to think of people struggling with alcohol as those who are at rock bottom. And if we just continue to keep that perception that they are the people who, as you say, are, you know, kind of found in a skip, you know, or pouring vodka on the cornflakes, if we carry on with just that perception, then for so many people, we feel we're thrown clear. You know, that's what happened to me for years. I knew that I didn't fit that demographic. So therefore, I had to assume that I was perfectly okay. Whereas actually, it was only when I realized that well, in my opinion, it would be the majority of people who drink are just like me, drinking or how I was, drinking far more than they want to, far more regularly than they want to, but just don't feel they can get out of the alcohol trap. I mean, did you uncover any statistics at all?
I mean, yeah, there are. I'm off the top of my head, I'm going to struggle to remember the figures. I've got my book in front of me, so I'm rapidly looking through it while you talk. But they're in the book. I mean, I've got 300 academic references in the book. I tried to justify every single point I was making and give the evidence of it. So I didn't want to say, look, there's a high incidence without saying where that's stated. So there is, at the end of every chapter in the book, you'll find, you know, 20 direct links that you can follow to find out, you know, what the figures are if you want to.
Yeah.
But I think this does reinforce the point we, you know, what we started on, which is saying, well, what is a high functioning alcoholic? And what you know, what you're saying, or high functioning, alcoholic, what you're saying is that what you were experiencing in terms of you were, is that right? Am I right, Janie?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't use the phrase alcoholic personally. Okay. I find it, you know, we could do another whole series of podcasts on just on that word. I would say I was, a high bottom drinker. I was drinking more than I wanted to, but my term is grey area drinker. I wasn't at rock bottom, but I wasn't okay either. I was somewhere on that booze spectrum, as are so many people.
Yeah.
And thank God you don't have to be at rock bottom before you get off, right?
No, absolutely.
But I wouldn't use the term alcoholic simply because that has so many other connotations and tends to suggest that that's a disease, in inverted commas, which is not my perception.
No, I agree with that. I've said in the book, I say in the book that it's, I consider it a condition, not a disease. And that's to do with the basis of what is a disease. And if you look at, I'd look a little bit at that, saying in terms of the sort of history of naming diseases and how they are described by the medical profession. So yes, I'm totally supportive of that point, actually, that I don't consider it a disease. I believe it. I think the label condition, if you want a label, some people find that's not helpful. But I would describe it, I always describe it as a condition. And that is treatable. And also, and I think this was the sad thing that I think, because I did go to AA. I tried many different ways to quit, Janie.
Well, just talk us through what happened when you first discovered that, you know, when you first kind of realized that something was going, you know, going wrong, as it were.
Well, you know, it started from, I mean, I talk about these, I split life up into different stages. You know, it's like I say every 20 years, you're in a different stage of life.
Yeah.
You know, and there's dangers at every stage. If you're in the sort of first 20 years of life, there's evidence that, teenage drinking, if you drink at 14, 15, there's a high incidence of people becoming alcoholic later in life. And there's evidence there in the book. And then what would be the stage, you know, at the start of after 20 years at university, many people start drinking to have peer acceptance. Mm-hmm. And I look at some studies about that and how that binge drinking sort of develops. And then you go on to your career and you start becoming more of a habitual drinker because there's, and that means there's a pattern developing. So you're seeing that you're celebrating the end of the week by going out with your mates or with your work colleagues, and that could, you know, on the weekend, and then that can lead to, you know, more regularly drinking on a daily basis. And so I think for me personally, it was sort of later on in life, I'd say in my 40s really, where I started, it became every day. And that if I wasn't having a drink, and it didn't have to be, you know, again, like you said, it wasn't kind of falling on the floor or not being able to function, but it was the case of saying, you know, at the end of the day, after I finish work, I want to have a drink. And if I didn't have a drink, then there was something wrong. And this is where it became, and I found I was going to the off license or whatever, the supermarket to get, or the pub to buy drinks as a matter of routine. And sometimes even when I didn't even feel like it, I've got to go and have a drink. Because I've had such a day, you know, and that was when I realized, hold on a second, there's something not quite right here. And, you know, and then you start this pattern of trying to control, moderate. And I think many people who've got, you know, who come up with this problem and start saying, okay, I'll only drink on these certain days, or, you know, I won't drink between these times.
Yeah, it's exhausting, isn't it? Even just talking about it.
Exactly. And I mean, the scary thing is, I used to start taking credit, saying, look, you know, if my wife said, you know, oh, you're starting a bit early. I'm like looking at my watch saying, well, look, it's 6 o'clock. I've been waiting till 6 o'clock, you know. And then it would be, well, look, it's 5 o'clock or it's 5:30 or, you know, it doesn't matter. But the point is, I was like living my life according to a schedule by this drug. And this drug was determining how I was living my life. And then I said, OK, I'm going to try and control it. Like I said, moderate it. And it's impossible. And I was, you know, I was in tears. I mean, I used to try everything I can possibly think of. I'd go for long walks. And, you know, when I say long, I'd be walking for 3 to 5 miles after work. And just so I wouldn't even think about going to the off license or getting a drink. And then I'd walk home and I'd be in tears. I mean, I'd actually be in tears because I was like still thinking about having a drink.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it's in my head. And it was like, how I've just walked for 5 miles, you know, and I'm still in my head saying, well, why don't I go and get a drink? And I was, you know, sort of pulling my hair out. Even when I didn't have much hair at that time. Oh, I still don't. And it was really, I didn't know where to turn. I just didn't know where to turn. And then everyone thinks of the AA.
Yeah.
And so I did that.
How long ago was this, Mark, when you first went to AA then?
I can't remember the exact time, but it was in my early 40s and I decided that I needed help and I couldn't do it on my own. That's what it was really. But I didn't like, I found it, I really struggled with the whole philosophy of the AA. I don't know. I think it's in my book, but basically my principal concerns were that I didn't think it was a disease. I didn't think it was incurable. And I didn't believe in the higher power relieving, you know, my responsibility to a higher power. Now I do believe in a higher power, ironically enough, but I didn't feel I didn't feel comfortable with that solution. And in my book, I was really careful to make it secular, because I struggled with that, with the AA, that, you know, you had to give up, you know, you're sort of almost like your free will. And even though I'm a believer, so it's a bit ironic, I know, but sometimes life doesn't fit into simple boxes.
What you mean, you mean you're a Christian, so you think,
yeah
I mean, I don't think the two things are related in any way. Tell me what, sorry, I keep interrupting you, tell me happened for you. you didn't like AA, that didn't work.
Work. So what was next? Well, but the next thing was bibliotherapy, was Alan Carr.
Right.
I've heard other people mention him on your show.
Yeah.
And
the seminars or the book or both.
The lady you had on the other week, she did the seminar, didn't she? But I did the book, but yeah. I quit smoking using Alan Carr, which was, I was amazed about. I thought that was unbelievable. Yeah. Then I saw he had a book, the Easy Way to Control Drinking, and I tried that. And I was amazed because I didn't think I had a chance in it working. And it did, but it wasn't a solution, a permanent solution. It worked for about 3 months. And then I was back to drinking. Now you could say, well, that's because you didn't read it properly. I swear I did. I swear I read that really carefully and I believed everything. And, you know, I dedicate my book to Alan Carr because I think the guy's, you know, figurehead. But I also dedicate my book to, you know, Aaron T. Beck, Dr. Aaron T. Beck, who invented cognitive behavioral therapy. Because what Aaron T. Beck has is he had the science behind it. So, you know, for me, it was a case of Alan Carr, you know, had the instinct, he had the idea, he had the possibility, and he didn't really have any science. He had a lot of analogies and he had a lot of, like, you know, it's a very patriarchal, and he kind of, you know, very supportive, very coaching, very encouraging. But it wasn't really scientific based. And what I wanted was a permanent cure. You know, this is what I didn't want to keep on going, like, from quitting. Because you see, anyone can, I think, Jenny, anyone can quit, really. I don't think quitting's a problem.
Yeah, it's staying stopped.
Yeah, it's staying, you know, everyone can do a day or a few days or a week or a month or a couple of months, or, you know, there's no problem with that. I'm in my Facebook group, which is Be Happy Sober. I call it Be Happy Sober because anyone could be sober miserable. You know, I've done it. I've been absolutely miserable being sober and frustrated, trying to use willpower and having these awful cravings and being in despair. And thinking there's no solution. And so I wanted to find a permanent solution. And that's when I found, by reading a lot of this academic research, going back to primary sources. So what were the actual experiments that were done on, you know, animals, on humans, and what's the sort of the metadata saying? And going through all of that. And you know, really objectively, because obviously my life was at stake. I sometimes think I wrote that book really to me, you know, addressing me, saying, look, you know, I was such a cynical, nothing's going to work, didn't believe any method would permanently cure. So I was trying to convince myself of the best way based on the best evidence I could find. And that led me to this guy, this Aaron Tebeck, who and sadly just passed away. But his cognitive behavioral therapy for me was the difference in identifying underlying issues. So we're not just looking at the symptoms, you know, we're looking at what are the causes. And that is that for me was the turning point. And once I could understand that, that removed the cravings, you know. And if you look at Dr. Gabor Mate's, you know, he's getting a lot of publicity at him. I love the guy. I think it's amazing. In the realm of Hungry Ghosts, writing about addiction, he goes further than that. I mean, he actually says that, you know, all addiction is related to some kind of trauma.
Yeah, and childhood, adverse life. Childhood experiences. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or even inherited family trauma. That's the work I've been doing recently, is with family constellations. And you'll be amazed how much is not even yours.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think I'm kind of just, you know, very much kind of in the shallow end in terms of my book, because you're right. Is it called epigenetics?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
that's right. Because I have read a little bit about that. And I think it's fascinating that these causes could go back that far. But even, you know, going, so what I was looking at then is, you know, cognitive meaning, how do our thoughts inform our behavior?
Yeah.
And what is wrong with them? And what's happening there? And what are they based on? You know, so you've got different levels of beliefs. You know, and then we've got automatic thoughts, and when they're negative automatic thoughts, this is where it becomes a problem.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things with drinking, unfortunately, is that because you're drinking, you're not really thinking straight.
Yeah. Well, certainly, you know, after the first one, the game's up.
Yeah. So, you know, how can you, in my blog, I write about, you know, why I quit, and I compare it to like an episode of Star Trek. Because, you know, one scene, Captain Kirk starts attacking himself and he doesn't know why he's strangling himself. And it, you know, I could kind of really relate to that, because I was kind of strangling myself with drinking. I'm crippling myself on a daily basis in the evening. And, you know, my goodness, I mean, the lengths I went to in the mornings to recover.
It is incredible, isn't it? What we do to ourselves, it's just incredible. Oh my God, I look back and I think, how can I have wasted so much of my life? And every day you go, oh, I'll never do this again. And then by 6 o'clock, you're back on it. It's just unbelievable.
No one who's drinking can rationally think they're not doing the right. They're doing the best they think they can possibly do at that time.
Yeah, of course.
You know, this is the thing.
This is why we have to be kind and compassionate, because we were once those people.
Exactly. No, you're right.
Yeah.
And it's how do you cross that? How do you cross the point? You've got to have, and this is the million-dollar question for me is how do you get that little tiny little ounce of insight.
Yeah, exactly. So the light comes on.
A little bit of light, just a little spark, and then you've got a chance.
Yeah. And what was it for you then?
What was it for me? Sorry, I'm going back a bit. I'm trying to think. What was it for me? I don't want to give you a glib answer. So I'm trying to think. What was the thing? Oh, I know what it was. Okay. When I used to keep a journal. And I remember reading in my journal, I'd keep track of important events that I thought, you know, newsworthy one day. Mm-hmm. And I remember deciding, you know, I think it was just after Christmas. And I was like, all right, that's it. I've had enough. I'm not going to drink again. I tell you what, this year, I am definitely not drinking. So I get my journal out and I flick through the journal just to see, you know, what I've been writing. Pages and pages of probably not much of value. But then I see an entry from the previous year. And what does it say? It says, whatever happens, I promise, I promise, I promise, I'm not going to drink this year.
Yeah.
And it's exactly what I was about to write again.
Right.
And then went.
The dreaded New Year's resolutions.
And I was like, oh my God.
Setting ourselves up to fail, literally.
And yeah. It's seeing it in black and white, maybe. And that for me just like a punch in the face. And I thought, all right, I can't even bring myself to write this again.
Yeah.
And you've got to really sort it out. And you know, it's a bit of a cliche now, isn't it? That everyone says, you know, I got sick of being sick and tired. But I was.
You must have gone through many phases or many times when you just were thinking to yourself, there's something kind of weird here, because, you know, I'm relatively bright. You know, in your case, you're a, you know, high school principal or whatever, you know, and doing all this, you know, big time stuff. And there must have been part of you that thought, this, you know, there's something wrong. This can't be this hard to stop doing something. I used to constantly ask myself that.
But no, that's true. I mean, well, I think, yeah, when you're in the process of quitting, there's a lot of kind of battles with yourself. Mm. And it's kind of mixed up a lot with, you know, self-perception.
Yeah.
And I look at this a little bit in the book, because I believe that, you know, that you can't ignore the sort of facing some kind of home truths in a way.
Yeah.
You know, why are you doing it is not just for the immediate, you know.
Yeah.
You could say most people think, oh, okay, I'm doing it either to relieve something or to celebrate something.
Absolutely. And I think you're right. I think that actually that's what sometimes makes people put off stopping for such a long time, because deep down they know that when they do stop, they're going to have to face some stuff that they don't want to face. And we find this a lot in the sober club. People will, you know, they'll have an initial kind of phase of euphoria, you know, the pink cloud, as it's sometimes called, and then, you know, some kind of shit will hit the fan, even if it's just their own thoughts, and they'll spiral down, and then, you know, it will feel very attractive again to just numb away from it. And that's when it gets tough, doesn't it? Because that's when you've got to push through and recognize that this stuff, whatever it is that you need to look at, is going to come up for you whichever way around. So you as well do it feeling more resilient and sober.
Well, this is so true. I mean, I just 110% agree. I mean, it's, you know, once you quit, really the work starts.
Yeah,
now,
exactly.
If you, that's what I love about your work, you know. It's all about that, you know, positive reinforcement and you know, a positive approach. I kind of say in the book, and I've said it in my Facebook group as well, that I think you're going to have to do whatever happens. You're going to have to do the work, either if it's before or if it's after.
Yeah.
And there's no way around that. And I prefer to have the pain of doing the work before you quit, so that you're in a more confident, stronger position. And you're not having to face those cravings, those urges, and that kind of self-doubt. And so a lot of my approach is very much, it's a kind of holistic mindfulness-based approach. And the reason for that is to ground you, to give you some tools that you can use once you quit. So you're not kind of going into a vacuum, you know, because sometimes, you know, I think we forget how much of a friend alcohol is, you know, it's like, for me anyway, it was like a best friend, And whatever happened, I knew I had alcohol to support me. And so I'm losing that best friend. And now what am I going to, where's the tools that I'm going to use to cope with life's difficulties? Because before, when I got a sudden, tax bill, I mean, the first thing I'd do is go for the get a bottle of whiskey out, you know, or I've got some really bad news. I don't know what it is, but that would be my, where's my friend? And I need that now. So what you're going to do is when you quit, you're going into a bit of a vacuum if you haven't got any tools. And I, you know, for me, the thing that helped me the most was meditation. And not people got this totally wrong idea about meditation. And, you know, they think of, all right, now I'm going to have to convert and become a Buddhist or a Hindu and, wear long flowing robes and cross my legs in a very funny way. That's not it at all. You know, I can't do a half lotus, never mind a full lotus. But it's not about that, really. Yeah. It's much more about finding, you know, some kind of peace in yourself, some awareness of the moment in yourself.
Yeah, coming back to who you really are, I think is what people find, isn't it? You know, I've said lots of times that one of my clients just came out with the most beautiful line of, you know, I feel like I've been given a second chance at life, and I thought that's exactly it, isn't it?
No, that's really, totally right. No,
I'm ever so jealous of people who do this in their 20s, aren't you? How cool is that?
I wish that would be. You see, that would be if that would be my dream. If I could, I would give my book away to people. I shouldn't say that because, but to young people. Yeah. I mean, I want to get more involved with universities and speaking at universities because that's where I think you can make a difference. You know, in terms of lifetime. I mean, I want everyone to stop drinking alcohol. I'm not a member of the club that says, I don't mean by any loose reference to any other clubs out there, but I meant that in a very kind of in a kind of very generic way. But what I mean by that is I kind of believe that, you know, people should kind of stop drinking. I don't believe there's a midway. I mean, there are some groups, and this is the reason why I'm trying to choose my words carefully, that, you know, there's one called moderation management, for example.
I mean, we hear the phrase mindful drinkers, don't we?
Yeah, and I'm kind of not on that point. You know, I'm very much at the other end of the spectrum. I mean, people that do that, I counsel, I do, you know, breathalyzer before every session. I'm a bit of the hard old school type,
right?
But that was my training, that's what we always did, you know, face-to-face counseling, so I still do it,
right? And that's, so would you say that you work with a lot of people that you work with, then they have had rock bottom moments, they are clinically dependent?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, you know, one of my clients was a mother of six, and she didn't, what do people think's a lot? I mean, and it's also for her, she was drinking, I won't mention her names, but she was drinking a bottle of wine a night. And it's that rock bottom. I mean, she was not on the floor, you know, she was putting her kids to bed, you know.
A gray area drinker, you know, someone who can stop.
Exactly. And so, but she, you know, she had a problem with it. And that was causing problems in her life, and she couldn't moderate that. And so what is addiction? You know, addiction is when you can't control it. Otherwise it's not really, you know, and it's causing problems. And if it wasn't, if you could control it and it's not causing problems, then I don't think it's an addiction. So, you know, you can't say, this is kind of how we started, really, isn't it? That you can't really put people into a category and say, right, it's just rock bottom. People just at the, you know, that really, it's not that. Many of my clients are, you know, even not elderly. I don't like saying elderly because that's the category I'm in now. you know, let's say in the more mature years of life, and there's, you know, we're talking, say, 45 to 64, probably the biggest groups, probably biggest demographic group. So it's not the people that you kind of, I don't know, I suppose, I can't remember Sex and the City, but weren't they kind of, they were a bit younger, weren't they? I don't know.
Yeah, well, they're back now, aren't they? It's quite interesting because in real life, of course, a couple of them have been sober for years. People like Kim Cattrall been sober for years.
You're right, absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, it's not a stereotype. And for me, there's not a moderation. I don't believe in that. I can totally understand some writers saying, okay, well, you know, people aren't going to accept, you know, a permanent, because this other thing, Janie, is that sometimes people think permanent is a long time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Permanent is forever. They can't get their heads around that. So I can totally understand people saying, oh, look, you know, give it a try for a little while and then see how you go. And then, you know, and if not, it doesn't work out. But you see, I wouldn't take that approach because I know that you're not going to be able to. I don't know. Okay, sorry. Let me just qualify that. But I suspect that you're going to constantly struggle. If you're struggling now with controlling your drinking and I don't think there's a, I don't think there's a magic formula that you can take to control your drinking, you know, in a year or whenever, or in a month. So usually it's a month that some people have written about controlling it for. I just don't think that's realistic. If you're in the case where you've never had a problem with your drinking, then, you know, yeah, probably you can. Maybe you do have that ability. I'm not, you know, I've read what I've read. But I've read that some people can do that, that they don't have a you know, condition. They can sort of drink a moderate amount. So I don't say it doesn't exist, but I say that people who do have a problem with drinking, for them to become those people who can moderate, I think it's a bit like you're shooting for the moon, you know, and I think they're always going to struggle. And so for me, it's like really, it's a case of getting your head around, do I want to stop drinking? And if that's my decision, then I might as well do it well. Mm. And if I don't want to stop drinking, then, you know, and I don't have a problem, then, you know, then there's no need to go down that route. But if you're going to do it, what is dangerous, and there is actually some evidence of this, it's dangerous to keep repeatedly quitting. There's some evidence that if you start drinking and then you stop, you know, for a few months or a year, then you go back to drinking and then you stop, that is worse, in fact, than actually just carrying on drinking, you know. And this is, so people who are stop starting, I think they should really try and reflect, and it's really, really hard. Kind of somehow get advice, you know, read bibliotherapy or speak to a counselor or someone who's done it, you know, someone.
I guess you're not a fan of people who just do dry January then.
Well, do you know what, Janie? I hate this, right? Because you put me on the spot here, and there is actually evidence to show, and I hate this, but it's true, that if you do stop for dry January, there's a more of a chance that you will then, you're more likely to, no, excuse me. Sorry. No, the evidence says that you're more likely, there's a chance that you will not drink as much as you did before. So I can send you that study. But that's so the dry January, although I'm against this kind of just stop for a month because I'm frightened of there becoming a, you know, up and down. But the paper that I read said that the evidence was that it can be positive. So I am encouraging people to go for dry January. It also is a good test, by the way, because if you struggle with dry January, then it's clear that you need help, you know, and if you don't and you enjoy the results, because I think that was like yourself, wasn't it? You took a break and then you decided,
well, it just so happened to be January when I stopped, but of course it does make it easier in the sense that socially it's not so tricky. You don't have to come up with as many lies because there's more other you know, there's more people doing it at the same time.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, people are a little bit more accommodating, so it's you know, as good a time as any. But yeah, I take that point. I think it's true. So just tell us a bit about your book then, Mark. What you know, it's a hefty old tome, as you say, a lot of research in there. It's good. What do people get from it?
What they should get is what I was hoping for. I was trying to sum up for myself what works for me. So you know, I've been a I don't mind saying alcoholic. I don't think I'm an alcoholic now, so I think I'm cured. But I was an alcoholic, and I wanted to know. I wanted to reach out to someone who was, you know, in their 40s and in the same position as me, and saying, right, I'm fed up with this, and I want a solution, and I want to know what the evidence is, one way or the other. So, you know, that even if it's supportive or not supportive, I want to know about it. So I put, you know, there's evidence in the book that actually sex is better on drink, on alcohol. I don't think it is, but there's evidence that there is. So I put that in the book. I wonder what that was. I do apologize, Jane.
All right.
Yeah, a distraction there. But yeah, so what I did was put... the timing of these things. What I did was put down whatever the evidence was for and against, and therefore people can make their own mind up. Is it relevant to them? Is it pertinent? And therefore that's why you got so many references, because I can't say something without saying, because it's not just my opinion. You know, there's been brilliant books that are people's personal accounts of their experience in of drink and recovery, and they're fantastic. But that's not my book. My book isn't that. My book is more like a manual, you know, and saying, right, this is step one, this is step two, this is step three. And why step one? Because of this is the theory. So it's all based on evidence, because that's what, as a teacher, and used to work in, you know, on a sort of, you know, factual basis, that was the most important thing for me to do. You know,
yeah.
So that's what I was trying to replicate.
Yeah, great. No, I really appreciate the fact it's so fully researched. I mean, my book has an awful lot in it, but I got a lot of experts to write sections for me, because the truth of it is, I find a lot of that research really, really, really hard work, you know, because particularly as there's so much conflicting stuff out there. You know, I got a whole bunch of doctors and experts to actually write those sections. So yeah, I was very impressed. It looks good. Thank you so much, Mark. I really appreciate it. Let's just give people your website where they can find more out about your work.
Oh, sure. It's www.addictionhelp.agency. Or you can do it at www.addictionhelpagency.com. And basically anything with those Addiction Help Agency will find me.
Yeah, right? Brilliant.
So we put that info in the show notes for you, as well as the link to the competition to win the ED Spirits, which is, I think it's on our imperfectlynatural.com website as well, but we'll put all those links there for you. We had the most amazing day at Family Constellations last week. Those of you who've heard me talk about it, again, you know, tricky to explain, but incredibly powerful, literally life-changing, literally. And we had the most amazing day. We've got another one booked for March the 27th in Kings Langley in Hertfordshire. So if that interests you, get in quick. I'm not sure if the payment link is live yet, but if you go to thesoberclub.com, click on events, or just register your interest, we'll make sure you get sent that information. I think there's still spaces on Champneys at Springs in Leicestershire at the end of February, if anyone's interested in that. And I'm going to be doing a special afternoon retreat as well at another beautiful venue in Hertfordshire. Watch this space for details of that. And then just finally to mention that I said last week, so I was interviewing, I think it was last week, I was interviewing one of my coaches from the Sober Club. And I said last week that I'm launching my training. So if that's something of interest, I know it won't be for everyone, but if you are a coach or a practitioner or a therapist, or you just really want a change and you have some sobriety under your belt and you've got this passion that you really want to be able to help other people who are drinking more than they want to, people who, you know, really want to focus on self-care and optimum well-being without the booze, then check out the training. If you drop me a message, I'll send you the details if that's something you're interested in, becoming a sober coach yourself. So just make sure you drop me a message. Obviously, I'm going to say check out the Sober Club. It will be the end of Dry January for some of you. Maybe you've been immersing yourself in podcasts and maybe you're feeling a little bit better. Maybe not. I don't know. We have people in the Sober Club. You know, one woman said, you know, she listed a whole bunch of benefits that she has experienced since she ditched the booze just before Christmas. But she says, but I'm still, you know, I've still got headache, kind of rumbling around. And of course, if you're concerned about anything medically, obviously go see a practitioner. But often there's just recalibrating that has to be done. And it can take a while. If you've been drinking for years, God, it can absolutely take a while for this to come good, as it were. And in that period of time, you just got to really, really take care of yourself. It's so important. And don't try and do it at the same time as anything else. You know, don't try and ditch coffee at the same time or anything. Really make this your focus. It's so important. So if you are coming up to the end of Dry January, carry on. Stay dry till July. What can I do to persuade you? Seriously. Come and join us in the Sober Club. And there's so much positivity there and so much support. And it's completely non-judgmental. And some amazing content, absolutely amazing content for all aspects of optimum health and well-being. So it would be lovely if you can join us. Just go to thesoberclub.com. And as I say, if you're interested in any of those events or retreats or the Family Constellation Day that we have coming up, then just go to thesoberclub.com and click on events. So I look forward to seeing you same time next week, which will be next month. Really looking forward to interviewing Veronica Valley on the podcast. I got the opportunity to be on her podcast, which was great. And she's going to be on mine. Her book is out. So I'm hoping that will be in next week's show. Stay connected. If you're doing this hard thing, always reach out, always tell someone. Don't try and do this on your own. It's really tough on your own. You really do need support. And if you've been sober for ages, but you're just feeling a bit flat, then, you know, you want to get your mojo back. So, you know, just get connected so that you can get inspired again with something else if things have gone a bit flat for you for whatever reason. You know where to find me on social media, at Janie Lee Grace, and, you know, all the usual places. And I'll see you same time next week. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.